Good morning and welcome to WNHH-FM's Dateline New Haven. I'm your host, Paul Bass, inviting you to look behind the headlines on the stories that make our community tick. Well, Rosa DeLauro has been making New Haven tick for a long time. She's our U.S. Congresswoman, has been since 1990. She's here in the WNHH studio to update us on what's happening in D.C. and how it affects us here at home at a quite interesting moment in our nation's history. Welcome back, Rosa. Thanks so much for coming in.
It's a delight to be here. Thanks so much, Paul.
And we want to thank Bertram Moses PC, Gateway Community College, and Yale New Haven Hospital for financial support for today's program. So, Rose, as we talk, we got a lot to talk about today, from Cuba to healthcare. But of course, we got to get rid of the 800-pound, what is it, a gorilla in the room, which is impeachment, which is that there's a fast track to impeachment of the president in the U.S. House of Representatives. And as recently as July 30th, most of the country, most of the Democrats in Congress, including yourself, felt that despite allegations, serious allegations, Donald Trump has broken laws like the emoluments law, and had other conducts that would rise to the bar of high crimes and misdemeanors for impeachment, that it was not wise to proceed with impeachment. All of a sudden, last few weeks, that has turned around fast, including you decided, you were among the majority who now say we should go ahead with impeachment. What changed your mind, Rosa?
Go ahead with an impeachment inquiry. That is what the issue is called. And very honestly,
right, you're not saying what the final result is.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you why. One, I thought it was going to continue to divide this country, and we are already a divided country.
Right.
Secondly, I believe that this would then relitigate the 2016 election.
Which is something President Trump has tried to do from day one, to prove that Russia didn't interfere.
Well, that becomes a piece of this. But the other side, the third reason for me was, the Senate, despite any of the evidence, would not vote to impeach. They would vote to acquit. So that was my real reluctance in moving forward. However, the President of the United States, using the power of his office to pick up the phone, talk to the President of Ukraine, the Prime Minister of Ukraine, and use the force of that office of the presidency to get the Ukraine government to interfere in U.S. elections. That is illegal.
And it matters.
And it matters.
Why does it matter?
I'll tell you why it matters. You know, democracy, Paul, is fragile. We take it for granted in this country, that the institutions and the pillars of democracy are so strong that nothing can break it down. But we're looking at a president who now would undermine our electoral system. You made the point before, he has turned his back on the overwhelming evidence from our intelligence community that Russia hacked into the 2016 elections. And if you want to believe what he says, that that was not the case, and again, the evidence is overwhelming that it is the case, we now have, in real time, the president calling and saying, I need you to investigate my political opponent, dig up this information, and then, to hold hostage desperately needed aid to Ukraine.
Approved by both houses.
Approved by both houses. That's it. That is another issue. But even if that were not there, you cannot ask a foreign government to interfere in our elections. He's now said China should investigate and looking into our elections. We have this in real time. He has admitted it. We have the transcript of the phone call. We have his own people, Ambassador Volker and others, corroborating what what he did.
And setting it up.
And setting it up.
The new evidence. And again, if you're hearing it on Monday morning, you're hearing it live. We do play these on. I'm sure there'll be 9,000 revelations between now and the next time this plays.
Right. But over the weekend, we heard a second whistleblower.
I don't know what's there. But that we saw that there were other people who were writing memos and texts beforehand saying, this is what we're going to do. They told the premier of Ukraine before the phone call what was going to happen. They had internally, there were people who recognized this was improper and didn't want to go ahead with it. So it's a lot there. By the way, James and Bruce and Bob and everyone who's been checking in, Ian, thanks for listening. We'll get to questions in a little while. We're talking to Rosa DeLore about impeachment.
I just want to make one more point. You know, we have a very substantial Ukrainian community in our area, who I've worked with over the years. Before any trip to Ukraine, I've sat down with Myron Melnick and others to talk about the situation as they know it, worked closely together with veterans. In an Obama administration, I had been supportive of offensive weapons for Ukraine. I thought that they were trying to fight a battle with Russia with their hands tied behind their back. So when this, we didn't know why the aid was being held up. You know, people made inquiries of our office, and we were trying to look into it. We had no idea. But this is a country that has been invaded, Crimea, Russia invaded Ukraine. And you have
They continue to fight to get more territory.
They do that. And you have a newly elected head of state who is concerned about his country, who hears from the most powerful nation in the world, the most powerful political individual in the world, and has said, yeah, we want to help you, but can you do this investigation about my political opponent?
You know, I loved reading that transcript because Premier Zelensky before he became the premier, he played the head of Ukraine on a popular TV comedy. And he has a very good sense of humor. Mm-hmm. And when I read that transcript, I felt like he was talking to someone who watches TV a lot, which is President Trump. Mm-hmm. And this guy's whole career has been playing to a TV audience. And I felt that conversation was on two levels. There's the one that Donald Trump can understand. Yes, you're the greatest. I'm flattering you in a thousand ways. I'm going to do everything you ask. Please give me the money. And I felt there was sort of a Borat aspect to that conversation where he was kind of winking and making fun of the guy, too. But we'll let history decide that, Rosa.
That's right, right. So that was with, you know, and I quote my colleague Adam Schiff, you know, that this incident has really, for me, crossed the Rubicon. And I'll make
many points. I want you to make many. That's the point I wanted to ask you about. Why did this cross the Rubicon and the others didn't?
Because it really is, we have, again, in real time, the president using the power of his office to get others and a foreign government to interfere in our elections. That is the simple case of it. And that is wrong. We cannot tolerate that because, as I said, democracy is fragile. Our the institutions, our elections are critical, and the sovereignty of those elections, the sacredness of elections, is so important to us as a nation. That is where we derive our strength from. And we have to preserve that effort. And as I said, you've got the president who admitted to this and has gone further now in asking. He's called on China.
Right. In 2016, in the campaign on national TV at a debate with Hillary Clinton, he asked Russia to hack her emails. Russia did a few hours later and then waited to release that information, that embarrassing information, until promptly after the Billy Bush tape came out, the embarrassing tape about Trump saying things about women. Is the difference that he wasn't president then, and that's why this caused the Rubicon, because you can't impeach someone for something he did before he was president?
Right. I mean, look, hopefully candidates don't say everything that, you know, and being despicable as he was during that election. But he was not the president of the United States.
It's the office. This morning I read a story in the Times that George Bush in 92, advisors told him you could ask Britain, their government, to find up files of Bill Clinton's activities at Oxford that will hurt him in the election because you're losing this election. It's desperate. You got to win. And George Bush said no. presidents do that. But what a different time.
Huh? Yes, because it's about about how you view the office, how you view yourself. You know, and again, on this issue, you know, there are a lot of decisions that we make as members of Congress. I vote on all kinds of issues, you know, roads, parks, bridges, helicopters, you know, whatever it is. But there are some issues that rise to issues of conscience. Yeah. And you hope, and you try to explain what your position is, and you hope that people will understand, even if they don't support it. But understand you did not come to this in a knee-jerk way or based on frivolity or frivolous information coming forward, but based on substance, based on fact, and what, in my own view, but I believe in my conscience, for me, was the right thing to do.
Now, Rosa, you were careful to say impeachment investigation, non-impeachment, Bob. And thanks, folks, for questions. As I said, we're going to get just to impeachment questions first. We'll get to other questions later in the show. And thank you for the questions and for listening. Bob asked if there's enough support in the House to impeach President Trump. Or you say,
in,
we'll
in the House, in the House, I believe there is, because there is, you know, I think maybe some of my, you know, Republican colleagues would vote as well. I don't believe they are lawless in the way that this administration is. They're very, very good, smart people there. I think it would carry in the House, yes. And then, you know, as I said, I don't believe that there would be any movement in the Senate.
Where were you in 19 during the Watergate investigation, 1974? What were you doing?
Well, no,
you
I was working for
Frank Lowe, because he was in 76.
He was. I worked. I was with the Community Action Institute, where I was. It was part of CPI, Community Progress Incorporated. Community Action Institute, the Anti-Poverty Program. The Community Action Institute did the training of along the Eastern Seaboard of outreach workers, of personnel to deal with community organizing and that effort to connect people with resources.
In other words, people in poor neighborhoods with government?
That's right. That's right. Well said.
Do you remember the hearings?
I was just reflecting. I actually said to my daughters, my stepdaughters over the weekend when I was chatting with them, you know, you were too young. I remember a new revelation every day, you know, and in many respects, this is very, very similar, you know.
I was going
to
say,
that.
I feel like I do check
every
the times
day.
On my phone now every few hours, because there
right.
really is something new.
That's coming up.
So that's similar to Watergate. And also Watergate, people always said, and I've found this in many issues since then, that the cover-up is either worse than the crime or gets in trouble. So President Trump has said things out loud
right.
that the rest of us would think are... would get you in trouble, whether it's the comments about women or about, you know, he did pay off people he had sex with and porn stars so that help his campaign illegally with campaign funds. In this case, as you mentioned, he publicly said to China, please investigate. Did he get in more trouble with this because it was discovered and then there's the drip drip? Might there not have been an impeachment if he just said, hey, everybody, now I'm going to ask Ukraine to investigate Joe Biden?
Well, you know,
because I think there's a method to that madness of his.
I you know, I think there... You know, all along, and as I said to you, I had real reluctance in moving forward. I think that there was, you know, the need for continued investigation on this. Quite frankly, I'm very clear. I think the Intelligence Committee is taking the lead on this. Is what should happen, and that's positive. And by the way, I will just say I think our own Jim Himes is doing.
He's taking a lead that he's on the committee.
Spectacular job,
but Congressman from Fairfield County.
The point that you made. The cover-up, and given that this was a phone call, that then the transcript of the phone call didn't go through a normal procedure.
They have a secret place for the audio. My wife was asking about this. Have you guys subpoenaed the actual audio? Because we didn't get the whole transcript.
Right, not that I know of. I don't know the answer.
So how do we know what was really said on that phone call?
Well, no, they released the
transcript
that had
ellipses.
Yes, yes, yeah.
And they said it's
That's
not
right.
the whole phone call.
Yeah.
And then remember they always argue about Hillary Clinton's server. They had a separate secret place to store the audio.
It's not they. There's a place where you can put in, as I understand it, those things that are classified, national security issues, etc. This doesn't rise to that, but and no one is quite sure what else has been moved from phone calls that he has had with foreign leaders there. So the point is that we've got admittedly asking a foreign government to engage in our elections and to interfere and holding them hostage to foreign aid and then covering it up.
Mm-hmm.
So potentially, I'll use the word potentially covering it up.
All right, you covered your bases.
I want to be clear.
All right, and we're covering our bases with Rosa DeLauria, U.S. Representative in her 15th term. I've had the pleasure of watching all 15 as a reporter in New Haven. And she's on WNHH's Dateline New Haven, 103.5 FM live stream. Thanks, folks, for your questions, and we're definitely going to get to them in the course of this. We're still just talking about impeachment. I want to pivot, if we could, for a minute, Rosa, to strategy. So the dilemma a lot of Democrats have talked about is that when you look at issues in the country, whether it's health care, whether it's taxing the wealthy, whether it's preserving the safety net, whether it's a whole bunch of issues, Democrats consistently rate far ahead of Trump on issue, President Trump on issues. You ran on those issues in 2018, you won big. Now, before people decide to go ahead with impeachment, the word was that will help Donald Trump get reelected because he'll make it about him, he'll divide the country and stop people from hearing the discussion that the Democrats are so far ahead on. So now the dilemma, now the question has become, do you move fast? Do you try to get an impeachment vote by Thanksgiving, since everyone forgets everything 5 minutes after it happens now anyway, so that the 2020 campaign will be focused back on the issues? Or, as Elizabeth Drew, who covered the Nixon Watergate hearings, wrote recently in the Times, she believes you got to keep an open net because of all the stuff that comes out. For instance, just in the last week, it's come out that President Trump allegedly, his top aides, had his tax returns, told the IRS to deal differently with his tax returns than the way the law says to audit them. So her point was drip, 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 incredible stuff comes out. Once you start investigating, that'd be a mistake to close it off. Who's right?
Well, look, I think, and the speaker has talked about, and I concur, that we need to move, we need to move quickly on this, and the Intelligence Committee is doing that. It is, my understanding. I mean, they're working this week, their depositions.
Oh, they're working on their break for 2 weeks.
They're working full steam ahead, because the issue is to try to move quickly on this basis. And so the point is not for this to linger on and on and on. Let me say this to you. Before there was this inquiry for impeachment, it was difficult to get word out. I think you and I have had this conversation before. I mean, the public knows very little about what this administration is doing in terms of hollowing out the federal agencies which provide services to people.
I just noticed you had another food stamp cut. That was like on page 820.
Exactly. And what is happening with the appropriations process? We have not finished with an appropriations process, and I sit on the appropriations committee, that has real repercussions in terms of the government staying open or not. So you're right. Now, I mean, it was morning, noon, and night in looking at issues around an impeachment. Now that we've moved to an inquiry, it is morning, noon, and night. So we're trying to, I don't spend my time, every day when I'm talking to constituents. They don't spend their time talking to me. Only about impeachment, they may, but they are talking about student loan debt. They are talking about the cost of health care. They talk about their jobs. They talk about the fact that they're working in jobs and their wages do not rise to meet the cost to meet the rising costs that they have. And those are the issues. And we did run on health care and prescription drugs and ethics reform, campaign finance reform, and jobs. What people don't know, and I take it very, very personally to try to get the word out of what we have in the House of Representatives passed in the last several months. It really is pretty extraordinary.
Why don't you give me a hit of it?
I'm going to tell you. Getting big money and dark money out of elections. Protecting elections from foreign meddling. That is in a bill called For the People Act, H.R. 1. It passed the House of Representatives. We passed the Equality Act, anti-discrimination protections for LGBTQ Americans, employment, education, federal funding, housing, the American Dream and Promise Act. This is about dreamers. My bill, Paycheck fairness. Men and women in the same job deserve the same pay. We passed it with Republican support. Most of these bills, maybe single digits, but had Republican support. Bipartisan background checks.
And you're saying you hear as much about that as you do about impeachment.
You hear nothing about these.
So is that a good sign for what you want? Does that mean you could follow both Elizabeth Drew's advice and keep the door open, not forever, but not necessarily rush to a Thanksgiving resolution, and still talk about your issues?
I think we need to move quickly, particularly on this foreign meddling in our elections, and whatever the other documents may say, we need to move quickly on that, but we have got to do what the American public asked us to do last November. And you know what? Democrats won overwhelmingly. With all the president's talk about an invasion of people coming across the border and all of the garbage that they threw at the election, Democrats not just prevailed. There was a blue wave nationwide. We have got to connect with those people who said, take care of me and my family.
Will President Trump abide by the results if he doesn't win?
If he doesn't win?
Re-election.
I can't answer that, but I don't believe he will not win re-election. I do not believe he will win re-election.
Okay. One last question on the impeachment. Mm-hmm. A side story to this that has some of the nerdier people like myself really riveted is the role of William Barr, the Attorney General, in, first of all, getting involved in internal reviews of his own behavior, which seems kind of verboten. Now, traveling to Italy with someone who supposedly was appointed, Connecticut's own John Durham, U.S. attorney here, to investigate, to carry out a errand for Donald Trump's re-election campaign, which is to revive a discredited conspiracy theory about this nutty guy abroad who allegedly was going to show them that Russia didn't try to help Trump, but that there's another conspiracy for Clinton. And that they've taken Durham away from the U.S. attorney's job in Connecticut, where he does important prosecutions, to investigate the FBI and the CIA to see whether a dark state was trying to hurt Trump. And William Barr is traveling with him abroad instead of leaving him on his own to be involved in the investigation. What's going on with that? And why? And what happened with John Durham? He's the most respected law enforcement person in our state.
I think that William Barr has turned his back on his role as Attorney General of the United States. I think he's there as a shill for the President of the United States. When I said to you earlier that their entire effort is to dismantle the institutions that are the pillars of our society and our democracy. Justice, our intelligence agencies, discrediting them, our election process, all this adds up to flagrantly trying to dismantle a democratic country, small d. That is something that we need to fight for every single day. It's who we are and what this country is, and it's the strength of this nation. William Barr, in my view, should not be the Attorney General of the United States. He's discredited the office, and more importantly, he has discredited himself.
I think that's a good way to end this segment of the show where we talk about impeachment. Thank you. We're talking to Rosa DeLauro, U.S. Rep. We're on Dateline New Haven, 13.5 on Left FM, live stream to newhaven.org. So, Bruce, pivoting to issues that you are talking about. Mm-hmm. One is health care, where repeatedly Democrats who say we want to expand health care instead of cut it back have been winning. Bruce Oren asks, and this is a question you guys are getting that's being injected in the Democratic presidential primary a lot. Are you for Medicare for all and a version that gets rid of private insurance and single payer? Mm-hmm. Or Pete Buttigieg has Medicare for those who want it, expanding it to people who opt in to increased public exchanges, but letting you stick with your insurance company. Where do you stand on that, and is that the issue?
Well, that is a very, very big issue, including the issue of prescription drugs, the cost of prescription drugs, in which I've been participating in those conversations as well.
Thanks for the question, Bruce.
Thank you, Bruce, because I have not signed on to Medicare for All. I have introduced my own legislation, which is Medicare for America, which would allow for those 165 million people who get their insurance through their employers to continue to do that. We would begin to auto-enroll people on Medicare, Medicaid, CHIP into a Medicare program. An individual could opt into being from Medicare for America, or an employer, when they see the robust package of benefits, decide that that's a good thing to do, and then take 8% of their payroll and put it into the trust fund for Medicare for America. I've introduced my own legislation. There is no deductibles. There's income thresholds on a premium. There's a cap on out-of-pocket costs. It includes health care for long-term care for those on disabilities. I worked with Jacob Hacker at
from Yale,
who was really the author of the public option, and with Center for American Progress and others. It's been endorsed by the AFT and others. Strong piece of legislation. Beto O'Rourke talks a lot about it. And talks about Medicare for America. I think what is exciting about this moment, because my legislation is a path to universal care, as are others, but that we have a very robust debate, discussion, which is what we should have, of how we get to universal care, when just a few years ago, that was not even on the table.
So is yours, anyone can go into Medicare if they want, including employers, but you don't have to?
No. You do not have to.
But anyone can.
Anyone can.
Well, I could use that. Okay, yes. So mm-hmm. Here's one question I'm thinking about how this issue plays out. There are two separate kind of debates. One is the debate you just talked about. Now we're talking about how best to get to universal health care, mm-hmm. which was not the debate before.
Right.
Within that debate, Republicans and commentators are asking Democrats to raise their hands at the debate. Who's for the single payer and no private insurance? Who's for it? Is that a way,
no.
People like Elizabeth Warren are saying that's not the issue?
That's simplistic. I mean, maybe it's convenient, and I don't mean disparagingly. Maybe that's a convenient question, so forth. This is, it's complex. I told you where I am. Mm-hmm. I want to move in a direction of getting to universal care through a Medicare option, but also to say, you are 165 million people. You have health care through your employer. We are not going to dismantle what you have. You will make a choice as to what you want to do.
My choice is immediately to leave my terrible health care company and go into Medicare, but that's...
I'm just saying it's too simple. This issue is very complex. I spent 2 years working and talking to people about drafting this legislation to try to understand the complexities of the system.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just this or that, raise your hand, don't raise your hand. Let's have the debate.
Is it possible to bring what seems like a simple point into the discussion, which is that when you talk about how much will it cost in new taxes, that it will also save people by they're not having to pay premiums or they're paying much less for their health care than they did before. That's a hard one to bring out.
Well, look, I'm going with where I'm coming from on this. Yeah. So I'm not entering that debate. We work at paying for Medicare for America. What I've said is that you have employers, if they decide to put their employees, it's 8% of their payroll. We deal with rescinding the tax cut on people who are making over $500,000 a year. We deal with a tax on sugary beverages, with alcohol, with tobacco, so that we are paying for what we're talking about. So I'm not going in the direction, which is why I have not signed on for Medicare for All. I have found that what we need to try to do is to deal with Medicare and moving forward and also allowing people to hold on to their employer-sponsored
insurance.
Before we
move on, just Bruce followed up saying he asked about how much the insurance industry's role weighs into this debate. He's saying, is it because, you know, he's an advocate of single payer health care. He said it's just incremental. So is that really the best way to get there? And you're saying this is one payer.
That's one way to try to do it. And it's a good for debate. You know, what's really critically important on this, in my view, Paul, is let's not be adversarial. Let's open the door to a very good discussion about where we want to go. And I would last point on this for me is, in the meantime, we have got to keep this administration from their continuing sabotaging of the Affordable Care Act.
And that we're having that discussion on Dateline New Haven at WNHHFM, your home for community radio at 103.5 FM, live streamed at newhavenindependent.org. Rosa DeLauro's in the house. And Rosa, you've been involved in something we haven't talked about a lot, which is NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, right, with Mexico and Canada. And it's being renegotiated. Trump first said he's going to get rid of it. Now they want to give it a new name. What, you've been involved in a trade working group with Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House. You're negotiating directly with the with Trump's team. Mm-hmm. Are you guys on the same page of this, and how's that going?
Well, we're trying to get on the same page. But I mean, because obviously,
early in the administration, Rob Cutner was who's the lefty economist, mm-hmm, who worries about China, was actually on the same page with Steve Bannon, mm-hmm, on the threat of China and free trade.
Look,
and
first of all, I was opposed to the original NAFTA agreement. I was just recently elected, and you will recall, essentially because I was of the view that it was going to outsource jobs overseas and put American workers at a disadvantage. I take no pride in saying that those of us who were opposed were right. We lost a million jobs, almost a million jobs in the United States that have gone overseas. And so, and again, that's put American workers at a great, great disadvantage. So I was honored that the speaker, along with eight other members of the House, asked me to serve in this working group to identify the issues that we could negotiate with or wanted to negotiate with in terms of the NAFTA agreement. And there are four areas that we have been speaking about for the last year or so, and I'll be very crisp on this. One is that in this agreement, which the president has signed, along with Mexico and Canada, is a gift to the pharmaceutical industry. Give me a second to talk about
this. You got
this.
The second. You got 2 seconds.
Because this is critically important for people to understand in terms of those who want us, that we want to bring down the cost of prescription drugs. What this agreement now does, which we want to change, it allows the pharmaceutical industry to have a 10-year exclusivity on their patents on a biologic drug. Biologic drugs are the most expensive drugs on the market. The cancer drugs, the ones that come out that cost you $150,000, $200,000 for a course of treatment. They want 10 years exclusivity. That means we hold those prices at those costs over the next 10 years.
Why is that even a trade deal?
Bingo. The issue on biologics has never been in a trade deal.
Oh, that means never. In these deals we do, that say we're going to enforce the rules in all three countries and there's an authority that's greater than your own country's
Congress. You got that right. Yeah. The third piece is they want to expand the definition of a biologic. So suppose you have a 5-year patent on a drug. You change the definition, that can go to 10 years. So we are in conversation after conversation with the USTR about talking about, this does not belong in a trade agreement. The other issue is on what they called, and again, complex secondary patents. You know, the industry changes a word, a comma, or this, or that. They get another 10 years of exclusivity. There's a drug, Avastin, has 765 patents. They are precluding generics to come onto the market, delaying the bringing down of prescription drug costs here in the United States, yes, and overseas as well. We're fighting against that. The second issue is, and look, you know, the president stands up there and talks about, we're going to bring down the cost of prescription drugs. I'm going to be hard on the cup. Whoa, you just signed this agreement. You're talking out of both sides of your mouth. And this is an issue that the public does not know very much about. And we need to get the word out on this. The second issue is on labor standards. We can have wonderful standards on paper. And I will just say to their credit, and we've had good conversations with Ambassador Lighthizer. I've frankly had better conversations with this ambassador on trade than we ever had with either the Clinton administration or the Obama administration. He's been open to listening. They've got good standards on paper. What is the enforcement mechanism, which there's never been present? Second, a part of that is with regard to Mexico. Mexico recently passed a reform of their labor laws because they do not allow for collective bargaining. They have what they call protection unions. They establish a union with a company even before they have workers, and the workers have no rights. So they have changed their law, but the issue is, how are they going to enforce it? And that is the enforcement piece of that portion of it.
Matters here because we want to make sure that jobs aren't just shipped somewhere where they don't have worker rights and the conditions and the pay.
You got it. Look, and I just went. I was in Mexico. There were seven or eight of us who went. Four of us who were on the working group and other members of the Ways and Means Committee, including Congressman John Larson, who sits on Ways and Means. But he's part of the working group. He did not come to Mexico. And we had a chance. We met with the president. Well-meaning, the government officials, well-meaning, but demonstrate to us how you are going to enforce your laws. And to date, they haven't done that, or there isn't a budget to carry out that enforcement. We also met with workers. Do you know we were denied entrance into the Goodyear plant? Goodyear, as far as I know, is an American company. They would not let us go in to see what the working conditions were. We did meet with the workers who, when they wanted to try to form a union, they were told there would be no reprisals. 55 of them were fired.
Wow.
So that's what we need to straighten this out with Mexico. The last item is environmental standards and enforcement of those environmental standards.
Very similar to the issues that you were raising during Trans-Pacific
Partnership.
Yeah,
that's
TPP.
Right. Yes.
So I want to pivot to one issue that's really been in the news that you were on early, Rosa. Mm. You're chair of the Labor, Health, and Human Services Education Appropriations Subcommittee. Long title for doing a lot of public health stuff and labor stuff.
Right.
And one of the issues you were holding hearings on were the risk of e-cigarette use. You have another one coming up October 16th.
Yes.
And all of a sudden, this is big in the news. We just had our first vaping-related death in Connecticut. You know, these were marketed e-cigarettes as healthy alternatives, healthful alternatives to cigarettes. Like, yeah, you'll be addicted, but it's going to be more healthful. We found out now these horror stories about it gets you addicted much faster, and it also has other kinds of health dangers people didn't see. Where are we on that? Why are people dying from it? And what do you want to see happen? And the most harrowing stories with the kids, the teenagers who can't get out of bed without, you know, a hit and all that kind of stuff.
First of all, let me just say that in Connecticut, you know, we had our first fatality, and I don't care, one fatality is over the line. You know, people should not be dying. But in addition to that, I might add that we have now 25 cases involving residents from seven counties: Fairfield, 11; New Haven, 8; New London, 2; Hartford, Litchfield, Tollam, and Windham, each with one. And we've had our commissioner, Coleman Mitchell, who has asked Connecticut residents to not use e-cigarettes or vaping products. Now, you're right. I introduced in January something called the Youth Vaping Prevention Act. It would restrict kid-friendly flavors, close the federal tax loophole for e-cigarettes. In July, I introduced a bipartisan legislation preventing online sales of e-cigarettes to children act. That would require age verification for online e-cigarettes, the purchases as well as in person with a photo or something. Let me step back.
In Connecticut, we have a new law that says you got to be 21.
Yes. Step back from that. 2009. The Congress provided the authority to the Food and Drug Administration to regulate tobacco products, including e-cigarettes. Part of that regulation included conducting what they call a pre-market review. That is to deal with the safety of the products coming on the market. Neither in the Obama administration nor in the Trump administration was there a pre-market review? These products are on the market illegally. I have now called for taking them, banning them, getting them off the market.
So all together.
Until all together.
Until we test it.
Until we have scientific data that tells us something about this. I want to address your point about smoking cessation. Because people said to me, well, Rosie, you know, people are, you know, some of my colleagues. I did some checking on a scientific basis, and I did this with the National Institutes of Health, that there really isn't scientific data that demonstrates that they're helpful in smoking cessation. So until we have research and science that tells us how they should be used, what is safe, what isn't safe, we should say no, get them off the market.
And I'll tell you,
I'll tell you what my view is on this. The tobacco companies, I watched them raise their hand when they came before Henry Waxman's committee and tell us that nicotine was not addictive. I read when we got copies of the focus groups that they did. And they said, well, people who are already smoking are not our market. Where's our market? Middle school kids. Yeah. I spoke to my 14-year-old granddaughter. And I said, what's going on? She's first year high school in Washington. She said, Bubby, everyone is using.
And as you know, here in Hamden, the schools, they're closing the bathroom doors because some people are vaping and the kids can't go to the bathroom. I'll tell you how it looks like in an outsider, Rose, along with what you're saying, as someone who hasn't studied the issue the way you do. My understanding was that in the past, the whole tobacco industry's, cigarette industry's strategy was all focused on hooking teenagers because the brain hasn't developed yet and then they're hooked for life. They started losing that battle. People have been smoking less. Now they found a way to much more efficiently, much more quickly and much more intensely addict teenagers. And now it's way on the rise again, tobacco addiction.
It's going to middle school kids. It's right. It really is. And it's all about a profit motive. That is what this is, because they're losing the market and they're looking for the new markets. And where's the new market? And now, and I had this conversation with Secretary of HHS about 2 weeks ago. Health and Human Services, Secretary Azar, and I was in the room with my colleague, Senator Blunt, and my colleagues, Congressman Cole, and I said to him, we need, as a country, to get ahead of this issue. Let us ban these products until there is a review. He says to me, well, we're going to ban the flavors. Not good enough. And they're not going to ban mint or tobacco flavored. Go away from me. Excuse me. We are putting people at risk. People are dying. One person is too many in the state of Connecticut.
Right. Rosa DeLauro, U.S. Representative from New Haven here on Dateline New Haven on 3.5 FM live stream, newhavenmint.org. Rosa, I was looking at interesting statistic in preparing for the show. When you were first elected in 1990, you went into Congress in which 6.2% of the House of Representatives was female. Can I say that number again? 6.2%. That's less than one out of every 15 members of Congress was a woman. Now that number still not reflects our society, but it has almost quadrupled. 23.7% of the U.S. House of Representatives now women. So we're now halfway to, we're not halfway yet. We're close to halfway to the percentage in the population. What has that meant for you? What has the difference been being in Congress when 6.2% of your colleagues are female, and now 23.7%.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I appreciate the percentages. I also worked for an organization that helped to try to elect women to the Congress. But the issue is not so much the numbers, Paul, but what does it reflect? When it's about the agenda. What happens to the agenda when women are in almost a majority? But I'm going to, it was just interesting because right now, what happens to some of the committees and what is going on. We now have full committee chairs, and this is in the House of Representatives because we have the majority. We have Nita Lowy from New York, who heads up the Appropriations Committee. Nydia Velazquez, the Small Business Committee. Eddie Bernice Johnson of Texas, Space, Science, and Technology. Zoe Lofgren, California, the House Administration Committee. Subcommittee chairs and vice chairs, 39. That is in areas nutrition, oversight, energy, water, military personnel, consumer protection and commerce, a health subcommittee, diversity and inclusion, global health and organizations. So that homeland security, natural resources, you go down the line, and women are in key spots in every single committee and every issue that we face as a nation.
Has that mattered?
That's right. And it absolutely has mattered. I'm going to give you, it used to be, it used to be that all of the clinical trials at the National Institutes of Health were done, and that is our premier health institution, were done on men. Women and minorities excluded. Now, this didn't happen now, but when I first got to the Congress, I worked in a bipartisan way with people like Barbara Kennelly and Louise Slaughter, but Connie Morella, Marge Rockema, et cetera, to turn that around so that today women are and minorities are included in clinical trials. Look, take a look at the agenda that we are talking about now with the changing of women in the institution. What are some of the central issues that are part of the public discourse today, not regarded as fringe issues?
Me too.
Me too. Paid family leave. Mm-hmm. Minimum wage. 2/3 of minimum wage workers are women.
And where do we stand on raising the federal?
We passed it in the House.
Mm-hmm.
McConnell, and although I didn't say that earlier, all of those bills that I mentioned to you, they're there. McConnell, who describes himself as the Grim Reaper, will not bring them up for consideration. So we live to fight another day, and we will continue to do that. But minimum wage, paid family leave, paid sick days, schedules at work, equal pay for equal work, all of these issues are now front and center of our public discourse. That is a result.
And what about your own ability to operate? Now that the Speaker of the House is a woman, Nancy Pelosi,
right.
How has that affected your day-to-day life in the Congress?
Well, my day-to-day, look, being, first of all, being in the majority has affected my day-to-day
life. That's a biggie.
I now chair the Subcommittee on Health, Education, and Labor. That has the largest portfolio of programs and resources that face every part of an individual's life. I'll give you a for instance. I held the first hearing in 20 years on gun violence prevention research. 20 years we've been unable to do that because they wouldn't do it.
The NRA gets the government not to conduct.
That's right.
It.
We did it. Not only that, I put in $25 million to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention and to the National Institutes of Health to research gun violence prevention. Never happened in the last 20 years.
Did it end up in the final budget?
It's in our final budget. Mm-hmm. The Senate has taken it out, and we are going to have one hell of a fight with the Senate over that. And I'm going to ask people all over the country, why can't we do research on this issue?
And we are going backwards on abortion, where there are now state laws that are wiping it out, and basically making it unavailable, and the Supreme Court is primed to have some decisions that might even revisit Roe versus Wade.
Yeah, I think so. And what they try to do with a domestic gag rule, which would not allow places like Planned Parenthood, et cetera, to make referrals, et cetera, to women to make their choice of what they want to do with their own lives and their families' lives. We got rid of that in the House Labor H bill. Mm-hmm. But again, in the Senate had to pull their bill on labor HHS because my colleague Patty Murray is such a stalwart. She's a great, you know, a partner in these efforts and is fighting against what they want to do there. But in every single area, I'm a senior member now on the Ag Appropriations Committee, so we can there prevent them when we did the Farm Bill from cutting food stamps. Now they're coming around to try to do it, you know, through executive orders and so forth, but the fight continues. Having, first of all, being in the majority and having the opportunity to really affect the agenda is enormously powerful. But having women in the numbers that are there and the folks who have come, I mean, the diversity is unbelievable. The women who are who have served in the military, you saw, and we go back to the first issue that we discussed, was impeachment. These were young women who served CIA, Navy, Air Force, etc., who too were reluctant about moving forward on that. But they saw from a national security point of view that that's the road that they had to be for an inquiry. And they stood up. Mm-hmm. And they're standing up against great odds. There are a lot of them coming from districts which are very difficult districts in which President Trump won. So it is about standing up and having the courage and helping to change the agenda on every single issue that we take up at the federal level. Okay. Women are making their voices heard.
Before I let you go, do you have a candidate you're endorsing for president?
Not yet. No, I'm listening. And, you know, I've been of the view that let a thousand flowers bloom. I'm listening to people, listening to what they have to say. And it's very, very, it's exciting because I think we have people who are connecting with folks who have felt for years that the system is rigged against them, that they're working hard every day, they are playing by the rules, and they can't make it, that they're working not only one job, but some two and three jobs to be able to take care of their families. And so I think we've got good people running, and I will wait to see.
Mayor Race in New Haven, are you going to be endorsing?
Well, we have, you know, Justin won the election, and I will support him. Absolutely.
All right. And this weekend, starting Thursday,
yes,
there's a big conference at Yale Law School, mm-hmm, and the International Labor Organization is celebrating its first century, 100th anniversary, and it's about women empowerment and women building unions and worker rights. And people from all over the world are coming.
Mm-hmm.
People who fight for labor rights in other countries, and a lot of people here who work with immigrants. You're all over this thing. You're like a convener along, mm-hmm, with Jennifer Klein, an historian here who built it. You're going to be in the open remarks. You're running panels, closing remarks, and you're bringing three of your colleagues from several states, three members of Congress, to come talk about that. So that'll be a big...
I am very, very excited, and I was, again, deeply honored when the ILO, and I get to work with the ILO in my capacity as a chair of the Labor Subcommittee, asked us to engage and to be involved and to... also to help get Yale University, who was so open to doing this, and it has been a wonderful, wonderful collaborative effort, and exciting to see all of the folks coming, and particularly that several of my colleagues are coming to participate in the effort.
Bruce has a final question. You have amazing energy for 76 years old. Obviously, retain your full mental skills. How much longer do you think you'll continue to serve in Congress?
You know, I don't. Sometimes when I interview people, I say to them, I'm not going to ask you, where you want to be in 5 years. I mean, I don't know where I want to be in 5 years. What I can just say to you is that what motivates you, what's get those juices flowing, why you vote the way you do, what makes you want to get up every day and take it on, that's what is going to drive what I do and my future.
My argument is that Nancy Pelosi has shown that the one type of person Donald Trump cannot contend with is a strong woman, especially one who's been around the block.
You're here.
All right. Rosa DeLauro, thanks so much
for
coming.
Thank you. What fun.
Yeah, it is so much fun. You always prepare more than anyone I know for an interview, mm-hmm, even with a local reporter, and yet you come with, beginning with the most knowledge to bring to it. So I appreciate the,
thank you very,
the respect
very much
you bring to that. Thanks to everyone who wrote in questions. Sorry we couldn't get to all of them. Thanks to Yale New Haven Hospital, Bertram Moses PC, and Gateway Community College. And thanks to Brian Slattery, filling in for the miracle man behind the controls, Harry Dross, who's having a great vacation down in North Carolina, we hope. We're going to take it out with the Afro-Semitic Experience performing I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free from the group CD, A Plea for Peace. This is Paul Bass inviting you to fly free with us all day and all night long at WNHH, New Haven's home for community radio.